Good evening, and thanks for joining us on The Week in Review. I'm Nick Blumberg. It's been a busy week. Let's try to get you caught up. One story we've had our eye on for the last year appears headed to a conclusion, with the Chicago Teachers Union making a tentative deal on a contract.
We got it done. The first mayor in 15 years to get a contract done, keep labor peace.
This has truly been a demonstration of resilience.
Resilience that union leaders say paid off. Now it's up to CTU members to sign off on the agreement.
We need to get back to a time where we're a country that can make things, and to do that, we have to reset the global order of trade.
Trump administration officials defend massive new tariffs as stocks plummet.
It had a chilling effect on some of the chaos and mayhem that was happening. The teens saw the police moving in, and they dispersed.
City leaders debate whether to further restrict teens' access to downtown. Suburban voters head to the polls, with two-term Aurora Mayor Richard Irvin shown the door and a longtime foe of Dalton Mayor Tiffany Henyard winning that seat. And speaking of the suburbs, the Bears are once again talking up a potential move to Arlington Heights. And now to our Week in Review panel. Joining us are Michael Liptrot from Block Club Chicago, Shruti Singh from Bloomberg News, Violet Miller from the Chicago Sun-Times, and Becky Vivi from Chalk Beach Chicago. Lots to cover. Let's get right to it. Shruti Singh, the markets have been tumultuous with this new set of tariffs in place, the Dow closing down 5.5% today. You know, how long might it take to get a fuller picture of these tariffs' impact, or do we even really need to wait, given what we've seen so far?
This is all very new. People have been anticipating the tariffs, and there have been some incremental movements throughout the last few weeks, but this week was the big one in terms of the tariff announcements. So this is all very new to the stock market, all very new to investors in general, including some pensions that are watching this very carefully here in Chicago as well.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, you know, President Trump is saying, look, there's going to be pain initially. This was a very sick patient, as he put it, the U.S. economy. Is that message seeming to resonate with the markets yet?
I think it's really hard to say anything definitive about the markets. We've come off of a very long increase in the stock market. We've seen records just recently as last year. But now, within the last couple of months, we've taken a dip down. So if anything, things are unpredictable. So we can't necessarily say what's going to come out next week.
Yeah, it seems like there's probably a lot more volatility in store. I mean, we've heard a lot from local leaders, including Governor J.B. Pritzker, talking about, you know, the potential impact on Illinois, especially with Mexico, for example, as one of our state's largest trading partners. I mean, how much pain do you think, you know, some of the sectors of our local economy are bracing for?
Illinois has a very diverse economy. It has manufacturing, it has agriculture. These are all very large trade industries as well. So this is something that the governor and other politicians and those who are making the budgets, I'm sure, are watching carefully.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, Michael Liptrot, if you're one of those local elected officials, how frustrated do you feel right now? You know, it seems like there's probably a pretty limited set of options that folks like Governor Pritzker have.
Yeah, it's definitely limited. And when thinking about not only the impact of the tariffs, but of what it's going to mean for everyday Americans and everyday Chicagoans, considering a lot of people who are invested in 401ks, a lot of people who go to the grocery store regularly, it's all going to bleed into every aspect of life, because sadly, that is just how present the economy is in life. And so people are going to be definitely on the lookout. When it comes to local officials, they're going to have to lean on every assistance, every form of assistance they can get from in terms of funding.
I have a feeling we are not going to be putting this story to one side anytime soon. But another big piece of news this week, Becky Vivi, the CTU's big bargaining team and its House of Delegates signed off on that tentative contract deal, sending it to a full vote next week. What are some of the key provisions here?
Yeah, so a couple of the big, I would say, changes that we're going to see is the cap on class sizes. This is something that the CTU has been arguing for and fighting for really ever since in recent years, but you know, they like to point back to 1995 when their bargaining rights were restricted to mostly pay and benefits. They weren't really allowed to bargain over class size under mayoral control the last couple decades. So this was a really big win. They now have those bargaining rights back as of 2021, and so to have enforceable class size limits, and in particular, kids in kindergarten will probably see the most change, and kindergarten teachers, because that cap is reduced to 25, and actually at 23, they will get a teacher assistance, which is another big element of this settlement, which is that the district agreed to increase the number of teaching assistants by about 50%. That means probably around 400 teaching assistants added over 4 years across the district. And primarily, I would say, targeted at early childhood, as well as the class size relief is where you'll see teacher assistants added. Obviously, also, I should note that this includes 4% raises every year, as much as 5%, depending on inflation, which if we have the tariffs driving inflation up in the coming years, we could be looking at year two, a 5% raise for teachers. And then, you know, there's some other provisions that they were able to agree on sort of at the very end here around veteran educator pay also increasing, and changes to how frequently the highly qualified or highly rated experienced teachers get their evaluations. Typically it's every 2 years, and they agreed to, for some teachers who are high performers, every 3.
Well, you know, talking about those expanded bargaining rights, you know, things like provisions for unhoused students, for example, mm-hmm. some of these things that folks might think of as sort of outside the bounds of traditional contract negotiations. Fair to say those have been a fairly big priority for union leadership.
They have, and I think it's a little bit kind of devil's in the details on some of those provisions, and in a lot of ways they are more value statements than they are sort of enforceable pieces of the contract, though there are things, policy, we wrote this week about the new article around policies protecting LGBTQ students and staff, and a commitment to staff a gender support coordinator in every geographic network of the district. There's sanctuary provisions protecting immigrant students. There are provisions that, yes, go beyond the scope of a typical teachers union contract. And that's been a CTU shift, really, in the last 10 years.
Yeah. Well, I mean, certainly there's been quite a bit of upheaval at the district over the past year. The contract negotiations, they're going to be looking for a new, you know, CEO. The new hybrid school board is getting its feet under it. You know, Violet Miller, does it feel like having this contract deal might offer some measure of stability, particularly for students and families?
I sure would hope so. You know, I can't relate. I don't have any children, but I hope so. I've been seeing this over the last year, especially my colleagues who have been covering it pretty tirelessly. So it's been a bumpy road, but obviously, I mean, like you said, we still have a CEO search ahead. We've got some other bumps in the road, but I do think it is interesting that you know, we see some of these provisions that you said, you know, aren't typical parts of union contracts, because we've been seeing them pop up in a few different areas to try and combat the Trump administration's policies where, you know, either the courts are failing or, you know, the executive is just kind of pushing through. These collective bargaining agreements have been kind of a way to fall back on and create some of those protections. But we're also seeing the federal government limiting some of those collective bargaining rights for specifically federal unions like AFGE. And I know they've also interfered with the TSA union, stopping them from collecting dues, which obviously hurts a lot of the local union.
Yeah, absolutely.
So one of the things to note here is that it's been 11 months, almost a year, since the two sides have been negotiating. And the next budget cycle is about to start for the district, the school district, as well as the city. And so just as you're wrapping up this almost year-long negotiation for this four-year contract, the school district has to also start thinking about how they're going to balance next year's budget, which is something that I think a lot of people have their eye on, because right now, the CEO has said they have enough money to cover the increase for this year, but he's worried. Even though he's outgoing, he's worried about future budgets.
Yeah, I mean, is there a concern sort of about a structural deficit here?
Yes. And I would also add, so the first year of the contract actually applies to this past school year that we're about to end here, and they have said, yes, that they will be able to settle their books and pay for the year's costs. But the next three are going to be very challenging. And as Violet mentioned, you know, the Trump administration is doing a lot of things, including today even, or I should say yesterday, the Department of Education sent a letter to states saying, you need to certify that your schools are not engaging in policies and practices that are diversity, equity, inclusion, DEI. Mm-hmm. If you are, you need to certify that and within 10 days. And if you are not going to certify that, we could withhold federal funds, including Title I dollars, which is the largest chunk of money. We were already going to lose or see a decrease in federal funding with the expiration of COVID relief money. But now, with this threat hanging over Chicago Public Schools on top of its structural deficit and its local challenges, we could be in for a very difficult, difficult budget summer and future cycles of budgets.
Before these federal elements are already taken into account, next year's budget is potentially already $500 million in a shortfall. So, I mean, these are new elements that could just add to that for the next few years.
And it's something when thinking about just hoping that throughout this process, when it comes to how long it took to get this union contract negotiated, that there can be some trust rebuilt when it comes to the relationship between the CTU, the city, and then with CPS, because with, as Becky was saying, just this larger looming threat of a federal lack of funding and federal funds being cut, there's going to need to be some local unity when it comes to it, because it's just going to devolve into further chaos. Right.
And let's not forget this most recent vote, or lack thereof, from the Chicago Board of Education was just a week ago that they delayed the vote in terms of the pension contribution into the municipal employee pension fund for the city. So it seems like a long time ago, because every week there's so many things happening, but that was just barely a week and a half ago.
Well, and it's interesting because unlike previous rounds of negotiations, and you know, we heard the mayor at the top tout not having a strike, but really the mayor is not in, he's losing control over the school system. You have a partially elected board coming in and exerting its newfound independence. And that also, to the point about unity, will be interesting to see how it plays out, because the mayor even today said, you know, if Trump were to meddle with our funds, we will sue him. And so that is something that's like, you know, he has 11 appointees on the school board, and he has a few others who were elected but are aligned with him. So I think you do still see general unity, but certainly as you start talking about dollars and cents and finding a way to balance the budget, you're going to get a lively debate.
Well, and given the uncertainty in the courts, you know, they can file that lawsuit and try to ensure that they get that money, but there's no guarantee that it comes through in a timely manner, even if they do win. So I don't think the mayor's headaches are over anytime soon necessarily, but that's sort of the gig for the mayor of Chicago, I guess. Violet Miller, I want to talk about a story you've been covering. Earlier today, ICE temporarily released a Venezuelan man it had detained so he can donate a kidney to his brother. Do we have a sense of, you know, how long this reprieve is going to last? What sort of details do we know here?
Yeah, so he's been approved for a year release, and after a year, he will be facing deportation again. That's not a guarantee. But I spoke to his attorney yesterday, Peter Meinecke with the Resurrection Project, who has been representing him through this. And they said he currently, at least, doesn't plan to appeal the deportation at that point. He mostly just wants to stay in the country long enough to be able to donate this kidney to an exchange, because him and his brother have not been proven to be a match yet, a process that was partially delayed by him being taken into custody.
Well, and given the Trump administration's focus on immigration crackdowns, increasing deportations pretty significantly, does it seem like this sort of a humane release is going to set any sort of a precedent, or is this something that it was just such a high profile case that they were able to make this happen?
Unfortunately, in speaking with his attorneys, they said that this is definitely going to be an isolated case, just because of the amount of publicity and eyes on this, in addition to the fact that he was represented by a larger group with more resources and legal representation. Obviously this is not the case for all of the folks in the United States who are under this kind of looming threat of ICE arrests, detainment, and deportation, or even just being taken to facilities in other countries. And so it's a very different reality for different folks who have different levels of privilege with this.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Shruti Singh, talking about one specific element of the stock market, Tesla stocks have taken a hit amid Elon Musk's increasing polarization on popularity. That's prompting some pension funds to question whether investing in the EV company is worth their while. Is there some indication they might divest themselves?
Well, along with the rest of the stock market, Tesla stocks have come down, and even more so than the rest of the market. Since about mid-December, when they hit a record, Tesla has fallen between 40 and 50%, depending on the day that you look at it. So the American Federation of Teachers has been asking money managers as well as the actual pensions to do a review. It hasn't been a direct, you know, ask to divest it, but it's definitely been like a review. How are you going to protect these pensioners? How are you going to protect the income of these retirees? There's been a few that requests that have been sent to very large pension funds, such as the teachers' pension in California. But here in Chicago, the Chicago Teachers' Pension Fund has received just a couple of inquiries about the holdings, not an ask for divestment. But still, they have been watching. And the big question here in Chicago is that the pension funds are fairly underfunded compared to their peers around the country. So if you already have an underfunded pension fund, then you're taking a hit from the stock market and then specific holdings. What does that mean for the funding levels going forward? Right now, Tesla is less than 1%. It's like 0.4% of the holdings of the Chicago Teachers Pension Fund. So it's a very small holding. Still, nevertheless, there's questions.
Yeah, not necessarily a major part of their portfolio, but when you're 48-ish yes. percent funded, you have to imagine you want to watch that pretty closely.
Yeah. And for context, I mean, the Chicago Teachers Pension Fund, like you said, is 48% funded, whereas the counterpart in California is about 75% funded. So there is a pretty big difference in terms of funding levels.
California is always braggarts. All right, whatever. Well, Michael Liptrot, we've heard some reporting that some older people want to see an 8 p.m. curfew downtown to, you know, combat large groups of teenagers gathering in the Loop. Is there necessarily much evidence that tougher curfews would be effective?
Not according to Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, who thinks that a lot of this would shift to communities, because this has really been an issue that the city has been grappling with for some years now. Mm-hmm. And we saw, tragically, on Johnson's birthday weekend, this teen takeover, mm-hmm. as it's being referred to, happen in the Loop and around Millennium Park. And with these incidents happening more and more, with people being shot, people being stabbed, and the tourism hub of the city, these things breaking out don't help. So people are looking for a solution, but it is still out there to be determined if that's the best, because ultimately it's the bigger question of what is there that a teen under 21 can do for free on the weekend in Chicago? And especially for those who don't have the funds to go to a game every weekend, what can you do to really take up that time?
Well, and I mean, you know, to that point, you know, Mayor Johnson has resisted that idea of, you know, bringing the curfew down by a couple hours. He hasn't lifted the ban on unaccompanied young folks in Millennium or Maggie Daly Parks, you know, after six. You know, Becky Vivi, does that sort of feel like a mixed message there?
It is a little bit of a mixed message. And I also would argue that there's, you know, how effective is the policy at actually deterring the action, or does it just end up criminalizing young people and putting in sort of these arbitrary rules that then, you know, empower enforcement? And again, is it there to act as a deterrent, and is it actually acting as a deterrent, I think is a big piece of the question.
Yeah, calling something a deterrent measure doesn't actually mean it works as one.
It will actually do that.
Yeah. Well, we had some plenty suburban elections this week. Violet Miller, you were keeping your eye on some of them. Embattled Dalton Mayor Tiffany Henyard, already knocked out in a February primary. One of the trustees, Jason House, is taking over for her. What are his priorities as he takes office?
So, I mean, the number one, of course, is just rebuilding trust between the people living in Dalton and the government there. And so, you know, they're taking some measures to rebuild the website, start putting out some more financial reports that used to be released. But there are also, you know, other issues facing Dalton, and that's what a lot of people are focusing on. You know, I was there Tuesday at polling places, and a lot of folks are talking about, you know, wanting sit-down restaurants, different businesses in the Dalton area. And so Jason House has said that's a priority as well. He's been in talks and has said that two were, quote, shovel-ready. So, you know, he's kind of getting the ball rolling on that seemingly. But folks, you know, again, we're talking about schools, infrastructure, things like that. They're looking for programs, you know, similar to what we're looking at with these issues downtown. It's just there's not much for, you know, kids to do for free. And these places. So you want to make sure that you're kind of building that up. And another complaint that we heard was that a lot of the local schools don't have programs for children with disabilities and things like that. So they're having to take their students outside of Dalton when that's just an extra burden on the parents, often on the students as well.
See, this is the problem with the death of shopping malls. You can't just walk around the food court for hours on it like we used to do.
Bring back the mall.
Oh, man. You were also taking a look at the race in Aurora. Richard Irvin fell after two terms. Tell us about who's taken over.
Yeah, so it's John Leish. He's been an alderman at large for a few years now, and he's been antagonistic to Irvin. He ran previously against Irvin in the 2021 election and got less than half the votes that Irvin did. So this was, a real big switch up. And in part, that's due to the fact that the Democratic Party put a lot of money into this race. They threw a lot behind him. And while the elections are nonpartisan, you can kind of clearly see the divide. Obviously, Irvin, having run on the Republican gubernatorial ticket a few years ago and losing, but also, John Leish has a very big focus on green energy. He was very vocal about police reform in 2020 and since then. And he's also supported, sanctuary city policies, because despite the fact that Aurora is the second largest city in the state, they are not a sanctuary city. And so we could see some of those things start to move forward as he takes office.
Michael Liptrot, we got a report this week, a follow-up report from an advocacy organization about a Chicago police targeting Black and Latino drivers to pull them over. What did that report find?
Well, it found that 65% of CPD stops, roughly 293 traffic stops made by CPD officers and were reported. And those stops were for really non-consequential things. They were stops for insurance, expired registration, really things that to this organization they don't view as meriting a full stop. And if anything, for communities of color, constituting worry and just increasing people's anxiety when it comes to driving. And a lot in terms of advocacy, a lot of thought is behind these as pretextual stops, to where you stop someone really not for the reason you say you're stopping them for, but to go into their car, to search, looking for guns, drugs, and such. And like a lot of disparities in Chicago, you disproportionately see them affecting the Black and Latin communities.
Yeah, and it seems like from the report, they didn't make that many, recoveries of a gun, or most of these didn't, result in an arrest. So.
Right, and then additionally, that disparity between what is reported as far as CPD stops and then what they're actually giving to OEMC at the state level. And so it's just a bunch of things as far as oversights when it comes to these traffic stops.
Well, Shruti Singh, once again, Bears changing their tone, now looking again at Arlington Heights for a potential new stadium. Obviously, this is going to be a big deal that lawmakers at all levels are going to need to sign off on. Do you think the back and forth is getting a little frustrating for elected leaders?
I have not spoken with the officials at the state level in the last week, but every time I have asked them this question, they say there is no interest at this point in putting state funding into a Bears stadium. So that's the latest I know, but I haven't asked anyone in the last couple of days about it.
Well, and as you said, there's a new mayor, in Arlington Heights, so that could be playing into this as well, potentially.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're looking at, potentially starting over in some respects here, but I think the Bears would probably be better off trying to pitch this after this next season.
Yeah, see how they actually do. But, Mayor Brandon Johnson's still here with full-throated support for the idea of a lakefront plan and still kind of out there on his own, as it seems like.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think the question for him now is that where you want to spend your political capital?
Right. Because
in Springfield or elsewhere.
I mean, and your money.
And your money. Right. I mean, the purse strings are tightening and...
Yeah, when they already have plenty of asks from Springfield, like for more CPS funding, that does not appear to be forthcoming.
Correct.
So you have to imagine that that's going to factor into the political calculus there a little bit.
Exactly.
All right. Well, whether it's Chicago or Arlington Heights, you are all a great panel, but we are out of time for this week. So our thanks to Michael Liptrot, Shruti Singh, Violet Miller, and Becky Vivi. We're back to wrap things up right after this.
Tonight's presentation of Chicago Tonight, Week in Review, is made possible in part by Ann and Rich Carr, BNSF Railway, Francine and Dr. Anthony Brown, and the Mullenhauer Progressive Philanthropic Fund in honor of Ida Mullenhauer, supporting quality journalism. Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation. Additional support is provided by
And that's our show for this Friday night. Be sure to sign up for our free email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan. That's at WTTW.com/newsletter. Plenty of good stuff in there. Now for the Week in Review, I'm Nick Blumberg. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay informed. Have a great weekend. All right, Michael, you had a piece earlier this week about a push to get new owners of a bakery on the West Side to hire local workers instead of temps. What's the issue there?
Yep, so at Clover Hill Bakery, they've had multiple owners. And with this most recent owner that took over the bakery at the beginning of March, their standard is to use temp agencies. But organizers are saying that does not prioritize local hiring. So earlier this week, there was a demonstration in front of the bakery really to pressure and demand that they take into consideration and preserve local hiring. So keeping people from Galewood, Austin, working at the factory and not temp agencies that have a lot of turnover. Because ultimately, with the turnover, it doesn't create any sort of consistency for the work base.
Right, and you can imagine, it's not necessarily a stable employment opportunity for the folks who are coming in as temps.
Right.
And what kind of a reaction did the leaders have, the management have?
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm serving Chicago for 37 years.